Welcome to the Lentil Intervention Podcast, talking all things movement, whole food nutrition and environmental wellness with your hosts, Ben and Emma.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 17 for season 2. My name is Ben Adelberg.
And I'm Emma Strutt.
Now, remember to please, as always, subscribe to this podcast and share it with your friends. Now, back in episode 7 earlier this year, you will recall we had a chat with Peter Eastwood, a New Zealand philanthropist, conservationist, and founder of Tanglewood Foundation. Basically an all-around nice guy. And amongst all the incredible work and projects he supports, Peter is super passionate about rhino conservation.
That's right. So today we are very fortunate to be chatting with Kennedy Zakia, president and founder of the Council of Contributors, a non-profit organisation that raises funds to support rhino organisations in South Africa and Kenya. So a rhino is actually killed on average every 8 hours for its horn, and their numbers are dropping rapidly. So this is a hugely important global issue if we want to save these beautiful creatures before it's too late. So Kennedy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Kennedy, it's taken us a long while to finally get you on the show. It's been our own little personal project to do this. And that is because you're literally all over the place. Now, tell us a little bit about your background, because it's not starting with conservation. You've actually got a different background. And and how you eventually got into it and how you split your time between the two.
Yeah, thanks. I know I'm a little bit of a moving target, and I have a very big footprint in life because I'm originally from the States, from Minnesota, and that happens to be where I am today, but I'm not here very often. I more or less now I'm splitting my time between Nairobi, Kenya, which is officially, I guess, where my stuff is. I'm paying rent in Nairobi, and in South Africa. So I have residency status in South Africa, and I am there more than 50% of the year, and probably most of the last 20 years or so, I'd say I've primarily lived in South Africa, and that's originally started with my career, which has been in advertising, and I took a job with a global ad agency based in Durban, South Africa,
which is my old hometown, which I mentioned a lot on the show.
It's such a small little place. I'm sure we've got a lot of places and possibly some people that would overlap. It's a cool little town right on the coast.
Oh, it's not a little town. Come on, give it a bit more credit.
It's not a little town. Although when I first moved there, you know, I was there when we got our first Mexican restaurant and the first sushi place opened. You know, it's this little up and coming town, but it's actually got a very good reputation for up-and-coming musicians, up-and-coming designers, and with my background being in the creative world, Durban was a really cool place to be because there was this little undercurrent of the design world that was coming out of Johannesburg and Cape Town, but it was new then. So I mean, it's a great place.
Absolutely.
So originally, we'll have to talk more about that.
We will.
Yeah, okay. All right, great. So I ended up moving to Durban to the year 2000 for the first time, and was in advertising. And I guess because it's so close to some of the major national parks, and you know everything in Africa is just sort of on the forefront of conservation and in the wild spaces, I just really, really, really fell for it quite quickly. And now I kind of consider Durban to be my soul home. It's sort of where I feel like I've got the biggest sense of belonging. And it's where my kind of transition took place, I guess, from working in a design-oriented career and then switched into conservation. And that happened in 2016. I was really fortunate to get a volunteer opportunity at a rhino orphanage called Tula Tula, which is in KwaZulu-Natal, just outside of Durban. And that changed everything for me, really. I mean, that's when I fell for rhino, head over heels. You know, the point of no return, no looking back. I just decided that I really wanted to dedicate a good portion of my life towards helping the species and the people who are helping these species.
Yeah. Now, the Council of Contributors, it started from a pretty horrific and tragic experience for you, didn't it, when you were actually working with some orphan rhino?
Yeah, it was pretty bad. So I left the rhino orphanage in 2016, and in February of 2017, it was attacked by poachers. It was kind of a big media splash at the time because it was sort of the worst version of what poaching is, because these four guys broke into the orphanage in the middle of the night. You know, they were armed and they assaulted some of the staff members, and they actually shot and poached two of the orphan rhinos that I had spent, you know, a number of months looking after. So it was pretty horrible. And both of those two orphans were 2 weeks away from being released back into the wild. Yeah. So anyway, that's when I think that event is what actually made me realize that I needed to found my own nonprofit and really just dive into this and do, you know, whatever I could.
So what is the organization about? Tell us, you know, what in essence you do through the Council of Contributors. Tell our listeners.
Yeah, so in a nutshell, I guess the ethos of the Council of Contributors, even though we are 100% rhino-centric, it all stems from this idea of, you know, if everybody just does their small parts, we can actually really achieve big things together. So it's kind of centers around the idea of harnessing the power of the collective, because I think a lot of people, you know, including me in the beginning, was like, if I have just a few bucks to give to something each month, will that really make a difference? What can I do? And I think a lot of people feel that way, you know, that they just have a small amount to give, and will it even make a dent? And for us, it's like, of course it does. You know, every little bit helps, and every little thing people do, it adds up. It really makes a difference collectively. So what we do is we sort of take on projects one by one. We center all of our funding directly to the front line of the poaching crisis. And we focus on three key areas. So one is rhino orphanages. And the second one is anti-poaching organizations. And that includes everything from you know, air surveillance, patrol flights, to equipment in the field, to rangers' uniforms, to funding canines and all the technologies that come along with anti-poaching. And the third area is adult rhino rehab and rescue. Because unfortunately, there's a lot of rhinos that get shot by poachers, but they survive. And so often what we'll do is support wildlife veterinarians who know how to give these rhinos special attention and long-term care. So those are our three areas. And what we do is we strategically target all of our funding directly to where it's needed at the time, to whatever organization or whatever person. When I say person, it could be a wildlife veterinarian or a private rhino owner who we know and trust, and who we know has the right intent for the species, and then we offer them funding, because it's tough out there in South Africa to raise enough money to protect rhino. They're really expensive to keep protected, and unfortunately, it does require around the clock anti-poaching teams to do the job. So it's a big stressful deal for people who own rhinos.
What was the very first project that you got involved with?
The very first project, it was tiny. You know, we just launched. It was in June 2017 is when I launched the official nonprofit. The first thing we did was bought four pair of boots for the rhino monitors at Tula Tula, who were out in the field, and they were basically spending, you know, almost full time. There were two rangers with the adult rhinos, and yeah, we bought four pair of boots. That was our thing. And then that's a good question, because what we did last week was we just sent a ranger team of 80 new field boots. So that's kind of a fun thing. We were able to get the entire team a new pair of boots for winter, because just, you know, these guys who are out there in all conditions all through the night, rain or shine. I mean, it doesn't matter. You have to be out there on patrol, and just, you know, if you've got a hole in your boot and it's raining or there's a little rock, it's just, sometimes it's these basic things which go a long way for morale with some of these teams. So that was our very first little project.
And, you know, you say you split your time between Durban and Nairobi. Is that's obviously you're chasing to oversee where the projects are, where the two biggest demands are, I take it. Is that the rationale behind that?
Yeah, more or less. I mean, it's really interesting because the two countries are completely different in terms of what's going on with the rhino populations and poaching. So South Africa has, as you probably know, it has about 70% of the world's remaining rhinos in South Africa. So of course that's what draws all the syndicates and the poaching rings. They go to South Africa because that's where there's the densest population. So South Africa is this constant struggle of how do you stay one step ahead of the poachers? You know, how do you fund people to keep armed men on the ground all the time? It's this war. It's a struggle. And it's often quite heavy. And in Kenya, they, for the past, I don't know, decade at least, have been growing their rhino population. Most of the reserves we work with and support have populations that have almost had zero poaching over the past few years, and their populations are making a comeback. And those rhinos and populations and genetics will be super important for Eastern Africa, for one, but ultimately could seed other countries, other areas, other reserves where rhinos have been poached out. So it's very hopeful. So when I'm working in Kenya, everybody's hopeful and there's no poaching and we don't dehorn rhinos in Kenya. You know, the rhinos have their horns. It feels like it should. But because South Africa is where all the action is and the poaching is, we focus the majority of our funding down there.
Yeah. And what are the statistics like in South Africa? Are the, like, is the birth rate still ahead of the poaching numbers, or have we reached that tipping point?
Yeah, unfortunately, we've reached the tipping point. So, that is, as you say, it's when the death rate starts to outweigh the birth rate. And yeah, in South Africa, you know, basically in the last decade, 8,200 more or less rhinos have been poached. Just to kind of land, you know, poaching has been going on for centuries. It's not a new thing, but in South Africa, it's just that there's so much more money coming from the syndicates. And there's so much power that it's very hard to stay on top of the poachers. It's really getting tough to outsmart them, and to keep enough people on the ground is kind of a barrier between them and the animals. But in 2013, 13 rhinos were recorded as being poached in South Africa. And in 2017, just 10 years later, in 2017, 1,052 rhinos were poached. So that, just in that decade alone, represents a 9,300% increase in poaching. I mean, it's off the charts. It's just crazy. And now this year, Kruger National Park has released their new population statistics. And they haven't done it in a few years because everybody's been very concerned that they've been losing, you know, a good portion of their population. It turns out in the past, you know, 10 years or so, Kruger's rhino populations have been reduced by 67%, which is not good news.
When we talk about breaching that tipping point, what exacerbates the problem is that with rhinos in particular, they don't exactly give birth every year. You know, that's part of the issue, is it's more of a, let's call it a rare occasion. So, you know, when the poaching is happening, but birth rate naturally is not exactly a as common reoccurrence as it could be with other mammals, that's not helping the replenishing, if we can use that word.
Breeding is a really big deal, and mixing up the genetics and all of that. That's the scientific side of conservation. You know, those things really matter. And so when a female rhino reaches the age of about seven or eight is when she'll start breeding. And, you know, they breed quite regularly, but they have to be able to find each other in the bush. So the scarcer the rhinos are, the harder it is for them to meet and breed. And a rhino typically gives birth, it takes about 18 months is the gestation period for a rhino.
Right. Yeah.
And thankfully, most females over the age of seven, they are either pregnant or they have a calf. So that's the upside. But, you know, if you're giving birth every couple of years, if a female has a calf, it takes 18 months for her to give birth, and then she'll usually stay with that calf for about up to 2 years. So the calves drink the mother's milk up till they're about 2 years old. So, I mean, roundabout way of answering your question, a rhino might give birth every 4 years.
Yeah, that's right. Now, the other interesting thing to talk about in terms of statistics, and this is where, you know, this is a bit more of a personal background for me, is I've always been interested and fascinated by conservation, you know, living in South Africa. But when I left South Africa in 2004, you know, like you say, rhino poaching numbers was very low, and now it's at a ridiculous rate. Why that sudden acceleration in the last decade? What has fueled that? Is that because, you know, they've sort of poached more numbers in other parts of the world, and now, okay, what's left? South Africa, let's go there. Or what has fueled that?
Oh, I know. I mean, it's such a, there's a lot of factors, I suppose, that go into it. But ultimately, you know, the rhinos wouldn't be poached if there was no demand coming out of Asia. And China and Vietnam are the biggest consumers of horn. And these really unfortunate, you know, outdated traditions and these medicinal beliefs that are unfounded and in fact proven not to be true have somehow still stayed intact. You know, there's still horn is being used in traditional Chinese medicine. There's still a belief by a certain segment of the market that it could be a cure for cancer. So that's kind of one extreme. Then the purposes and the uses that are slightly more depressing for me are they're still making trinkets out of rhino horn. You know, you can, if you can find one and on the black market, buy a bracelet or, you know, these expensive souvenirs. And I think also the tough one for us now to overcome is that rhino horn has become a status symbol. So wealthy people will buy horn. And one of the latest trends is they grind it up and put it in red wine at parties, literally just because they can. So if it's a status symbol, that means the fewer rhinos there are, the harder it is to get, the more expensive it is, and the cooler it is, you know, to have it. And there are some people who are buying just raw discs of rhino horn, just in its natural state, and putting it in a vault to almost bank on extinction, because the fewer there are, the more value that has.
Wow.
So it's to try to tap into the insights into those cultures to figure out how we change those perceptions is really difficult.
Do you know if there's any marketing taking place in these countries to try and do that, to try and change the perception of rhino horn?
Yeah, there's have you guys heard of WildAid?
I've heard of them, yes.
So WildAid is one. They focus on the demand side of things and demand reduction. and they run campaigns, and they have been for a number of years using celebrities who are either local to that culture or rich, wealthy people who those cultures might put on a pedestal and have some sort of, I don't know, sway by, like a Richard Branson, and Jackie Chan has been in a couple of them. Prince William has been a spokesperson, and it's directly talking to those markets about the fact that this stuff doesn't work. It doesn't do what you think it does. And also the horrible thing that people don't realize is you have to kill a rhino to get the horn. So they pour millions and millions of dollars into research and media to try to sway people and change perceptions. You know, does it work? Does it move the needle? I don't really know, because we're still killing, three rhinos a day.
What's your thoughts? And I appreciate if you don't, know much about it, but what's your thoughts about when you mentioned the need to kill rhino for the horn, when we know there's a lot of dehorning projects and so on. But in South Africa, I believe, contrary to a lot of other countries, is when they, say arrest a group of poachers and they find a stash of horns with them, they don't destroy the contents. They don't destroy those horns, that I believe they're actually stockpiling them in the, maybe not belief, but the hope that one day there could actually be an internal trade market for it. What's your thoughts about that? And do you think that's a dangerous, dangerous road to go down?
Yeah, that's a
it's a very loaded question.
It is a little bit, because, well, okay, so, I don't think it's a big secret that South Africa is a corrupt country almost at every level, and, from the top government spheres all the way down. So if you have a country who knows poaching has been happening, who more or less looks the other way, and who more or less just leaves the whole issue up to NGOs, private rhino owners, and the people who actually care, then you have to wonder, do they see the value in the animal? They actually don't. But if horn is confiscated in an arrest, they do ship it and stockpile it. And part of that could be truly that horn is just no good out in the market, because it's just going to get sold and get into the wrong people's hands. And why should we fuel the demand? So that is one good thing, is that horn isn't going out into the world to get consumed. But on the other hand, there is a little bit of a theory, I guess, or a belief that millions and millions of dollars of rhino horn is being stockpiled. And if it was ever legally viable to trade horn, right now it's illegal to trade horn internationally, then someone would make a ton of money. So, I mean, rhino horn, you'll know this, rhino horn is the most valuable substance on the planet. Yeah. It's just absurd. It's worth more per kg than gold or diamonds or platinum or you name it. So, I think the government see some sort of long-term play if they, are ever able to legally sell it. Let's hope not.
Yeah. Let's go back to a bit more of the good news than drown ourselves in all these these sad statistics. Let's talk more about projects that you've been involved in, because you've been involved in an incredible amount of projects. So we've spoken about your first one and almost in a circular way, your last one. It's putting good shoes on feet of those that are doing amazing work. Are there a couple of other projects that stand out that have been absolutely either unique or made a huge, huge impact?
Yeah, I mean, they really range the spectrum. And it's interesting, because a small project to, the people who it affects is a really big deal. I mean, there's nothing we do to me that's really small in terms of the impact we have you know, on the people who are out there 24/7 doing this. But we've done a couple of really interesting, unique projects. Probably one of my favorites was in Kenya, actually. And there's a sanctuary way up in the northern part of Kenya, just 400 kilometers south of the Ethiopian border, called the Sara Rhino Sanctuary. And it started under this chap named Ian Craig, who's quite famous in our world. And the whole sanctuary is run and managed and employed by the local community. And they have never had a single poaching incident ever. And their entire population of rhinos are black rhinos, so which are critically endangered. You know, black rhino are actually pretty rare. And these guys, I went up there to meet the rhino monitoring team. Basically, these guys from the local community who live in the bush and spend their whole lives tracking these rhinos every day, 12 hours on their feet, in the heat. I mean, you name it. It's a grueling job. And they were sleeping in tents, two guys to a tent. They had no toilets. They had no running water. They were basically cooking over a campfire, like a campfire over logs and bricks. And I was like, this doesn't seem right. So the Council of Contributors raised funds, and we blew out their whole bush camp. So we built brand new sleeping quarters. We put in two showers, two hand washing stations, a new kitchen, a place they could hang out. And we just, I don't know, we just gave them a camp. We built their camp out. And they were pretty excited about that. I mean, it changes the game. And I haven't been back since it was completed, but I'll probably go there this year. And I feel like some poor goat is probably going to get roasted to celebrate. But because they're quite happy with their new digs. So that was one. And then, you know, we've done things like fund air surveillance patrols over really vast areas in northern South Africa in the province of Limpopo, where there's just private rhino owners with their own land who cover all of their own expenses out of their own pocket. They get no assistance from the government. And the syndicates get in there, and they rely on each other and their pooled resources for ramped up anti-poaching, especially over the full moon. And they'll just call and say, we've got poachers in the area. Like, we need air support. And we'll fund 5 days in a row of a bat hawk aircraft, which is designed to patrol really slow and really low. And to those people, they say that air surveillance is the biggest deterrent for poaching in their particular area. So we do some projects we plan for, and we know what we're doing, and we agree on the thing they need, and then we get it done. And some projects we react to, and they're very urgent, and they just come up spontaneously because it's wildlife. So we get a lot of calls to help with veterinarian services for a rhino that's been shot, or in the winter months in South Africa, it's really cold, and so we installed a safe heating system in some little orphans' bedrooms at night. It's just really, it really ranges. Every project we do, I'm so proud of.
So I would imagine now that with the tourism dollar kind of dried up a little bit since COVID-19, that, you know, the work we're doing is even more critical at this point in time.
Yeah, that's been a rough one. You know, COVID has basically froze up and squeezed off everybody's primary source of income, which is tourism. So, you know, small private reserves can still kind of get by if they have a lodge and people come out and you can see some game. And that's how they fund their anti-poaching teams more often than not. And without tourism the past year, it's just gotten worse and worse. And people are just absolutely squeezed. They're down to skeleton staff and guys who are at the top rangers. Some of them are now just volunteering, because if you really care about this, you can't just walk away, even if you're not getting paid. So it's putting people in a really vulnerable position because they've had to let go of some staff, which means there's fewer boots on the ground. And I think a lot of people are really pretty stressed about it and just hoping that things recover a little bit this year. Hopefully they'll recover. But yeah, so we supported a number of initiatives throughout COVID on a monthly basis. We bought hay in Lucerne for a couple orphanages, and we did this Bat Hawk Air Patrol, and we just helped fill in with some of the a couple anti-poaching canine dog needs. Yeah, I mean, we work really closely with a number of people, so I'm fortunate enough to know people I can trust. And then when they need help, we just dive in and do it.
Any, because I was looking on your website now, there's a few current live projects I can see. Anything now that's quite significant, or anything coming up that you may be planning on launching as your next project that's of, you know, unique interest?
Yeah. Okay. Can I tell you about the project we're working on right now? It's so exciting. I'll tell you about two. But there's one right now that is such a cool just thing to be a part of for us. So Old Pejeta Conservancy, which is in Kenya, I don't know if you've heard of it or not, but that was the conservancy where Sudan was for a number of years, and he was the last male northern white rhino alive on the planet.
That's right, yeah.
And he became quite a iconic symbol for rhino. And when he passed away in 2017, he actually got global press, and it put rhino kind of on the radar. Well, since then, there's been teams of scientists who are globally at the top of their game, who are investing in trying to save the northern white rhino as a subspecies from total extinction. There are two northern white rhinos left. They're both female, Najin and Fatu. And they're at Old Pejeta. So they're the last two on the entire planet. And the scientists before Sudan passed away, they had taken some of his sperm and one other northern white male's sperm, and they froze it. And now they're working on harvesting eggs from Najin and Fatu, taking the sperm from Sudan and the other rhino, and they're going to transfer it into two surrogate white rhinos, southern white rhinos, to hopefully try to breed a pure northern white rhino. So this has been going on for a number of years, and it's very complicated. And some of these scientists have actually invented the equipment that's required to do this, which is really fascinating. And so I was up there in March talking to the team, because we do some work with Old Pejeta every year. And I said, what do you guys need? Like, what do you need this year? And they said, well, this is the enclosure where the two surrogate females are going to go, where they're going to transfer the embryos and hope, you know, fingers crossed, hope for the best that one of them gets pregnant. But our team doesn't have a way to observe the rhinos, and we need an observation and monitoring platform. So I said, well, we'll build that. So now I'm working with, because I come from a design background, I said, we'll fund that, but let me speak to an architect and let me come up with a design that's kind of special and unique and is a beautiful space for these guys to spend, you know, they're going to spend 12 hours a day watching these rhinos. So we're now in the process of designing that structure, and I'm raising funds to help get that built, which we hope to kick off construction for sometime in July. I mean, that's history potentially being made and saving a subspecies literally from the brink of extinction. So it's very cool. And then I think towards the back half of this year, I'll be in South Africa most of the year, and we're going to be doing a lot of dehorning. So while that's not a particular project, it's expensive and it has to be done. And there are so many reserves who really need the help doing that. So that's our goal, is to maybe get, you know, 50 to 100 rhinos dehorned this year as well.
What happens with those horns that are dehorned, that are removed? Are those
burnt?
Yeah,
if it's a private rhino owner, if you had a reserve and you had 20 rhinos that needed to be dehorned, what happens is an official from the government is actually there. You have to get the permits to do that first from the government. And then they help oversee it. But the private rhino owner can choose the veterinarian and the ground team. And they can pick and choose who they want to do that. Because if you own a rhino and it gets darted, it's not exactly a stress on the animal, but it's dangerous to put a rhino down. So you want to be sure you've got a very capable team who's helping you do that. So once the horns are removed, kind of at the end of the day, they're weighed and then chipped and recorded and their certificates, and they get taken away and literally nobody really knows where. It's a very secretive, very confidential. I mean, sometimes the private rhino owner doesn't even really know where it goes because it puts them at risk. If you had 10 rhinos dehorned and you have $3 million sitting, you know, in your kitchen, then it puts you at risk, because once you apply for the permits to do that, it's in the system and people know. So before people dehorn rhinos, typically people get really nervous because the word is out there, and people usually ramp up their anti-poaching for about a week ahead of that, because I mean, my goodness, it's really quite dangerous to just have horn lying around. But it goes, you know, probably goes back into a vault somewhere.
So even though you, as a private owner, own the rhino, you care, you look after, you protect that rhino, you do not own that horn. That system just doesn't, you know, I mean, if I was a private owner and I dehorned the rhino for the safety of the rhino, I'd choose to burn it, get rid of it, remove the incentive. And yet that seems to be the disconnect. It's and even the private owner doesn't even know where that horn goes.
Yeah, you're right about that. I who knows if some private rhino owners dehorn and keep it. I really don't think so, though. I don't think that's something that people try to mess the system around and do. But yes, so you, as a private rhino owner, these people typically month to month struggle to cover all of their expenses for this stuff, right? If they could sell one horn, they might be able to pay for all their anti-poaching, et cetera. It's just that then feeds the system. You know, like you said, I would burn it too. If I had the choice, if I own rhino, just get rid of it, burn it, don't have it anywhere. But unfortunately, it's a really tightly monitored process.
So you are in an incredibly unique position. You really are. I mean, you're doing fantastic work. You're supporting amazing work. That's partially because you've had a personal connection to it and personal experience. But for the rest of, well, not the rest of us, for the majority of us that don't live in South Africa, that don't live in Africa, for many that have probably never seen a rhino, why does that matter to the rest of us? Why does someone in New Zealand, in Australia, in America, why should they care about the protection of a particular species that has no direct impact on their land or their environment? Or am I wrong about that?
No, I think you're right. I think about it all the time. You know, I come back to the States and my friends and family know exactly what I do. And it's like, oh, how's the rhino thing going? And it's like, you know, good. They're still getting poached like crazy, and I still need more funding, and I still need to figure out how we can have more impact. And I think it's just, but I understand it when I'm here. It's such a disconnect to day-to-day life to think of any animal that you don't have an affinity for, or you don't even really know what their personalities are like. You know, how do you get yourself to care? That's part of what we're trying to do as a brand, is tell stories that compel people to care. And we do not exploit the sadness and the death and the poaching. Some people do. It's a little bit of an activist angle. We don't really do that. But how to get people to care when it's the elephants and it's the pangolins and it's the tigers and it's the whales. You know, everywhere you look, there's some amazing, incredible species that's just slipping through our fingers. And I guess for me, it's something about rhino has to move you. Or I would say, if it's tigers or if it's lions, whatever people find, you know, makes their heart go pitter patter and moves them, just support it. Just support it. Rhino in particular, you know, they're a keystone species. They're mega herbivores. So they've been around for millions of years, and actually they are what keeps major ecosystems functioning properly. So even if you don't care about the animal, I mean, we all know that natural habitat is starting to just absolutely disappear. And when you have species that play a role in preserving it, I mean, I think it's just our moral obligation almost to help preserve that. I mean, white rhinos, for instance, eat all the long grasses. So they're grazers. They have a chin that's square like a cow. So they eat grass. And they eat so much grass in the savannas that it's the only way sometimes species like zebra and wildebeest and impala can get to the grasses that are shorter that they eat. So they follow the rhinos around. Rhinos' dung, you know, it spreads seeds all over their territories, and insects and birds thrive on that, and it increases vegetation growth. They wallow in mud, and that's what keeps some small water holes open and available to other animals to come drink. I mean, there's just all these really interesting things. I think when you dig deeper into any aspect of nature, that's what you find, that it's fascinating. And for me personally, I just, you know, something about rhino, they're just incredible. They're so huge, and they're actually quite gentle, and they're prehistoric, and they're kind of goofy. I'm just fascinated by them.
All right, so you've convinced us. Hopefully you've convinced the listeners. How best can we take action? How can we support the plight of the rhino here? Because we're on the clock.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, there is a little bit of a sense of urgency with rhinos, you know, just the way things are going. And are we going to let the rhino go extinct? You know, no way, not on our watch. But honestly, you know, it's what we were talking about earlier. If you start to really deplete the genetics and the breeding pools, this is no joke. I think it's that we have to do this stuff before it's too little too late. Because so many times you hear there's 100 left of some tree frog or whatever it is. You think it's too little too late. And we as humans, I think we have a really hard time coming to grips with the fact that something could be gone forever. I think especially in the first world, any first world country, everything is accessible, and you can't imagine that something might actually be gone. But it's happening, and I don't think we'll ever be able to look back and go, "Oh, no more rhinos." Like, gee, we didn't know. Wish someone would have said that. We absolutely know this is happening. And so, you know, for us, from the point of view with the Council of Contributors, we are all about this idea of people coming together and just doing a little thing to help affect a bigger cause. And honestly, just small donations. The funding is what we need the most. Funding and awareness. Awareness helps because it gets people to care. Funding helps us get things done, and it gets money to the front line where people need it tonight. And so I think what a lot of people who support us appreciate, I think, about the Council of Contributors is that we work with so many of the leading rhino conservationists that we channel our funding into a variety of needs and places and people. And so one month we might be buying tracking collars to put on a population of black rhinos, and the next month we're supporting detection dogs at a gate going into Kruger Park. And we just together we can do a lot. So I you know, people have a few bucks, it goes a long way. And we don't take salaries at the COC. We or a 501c3 nonprofit in the States. We don't take salaries. It literally, everybody's donation, the maximum amount goes to the front line.
Well, it really is that easy. I know personally, because I make a small contribution every month. It is small,
Yay!
It is, but it's you know, if you have any passion for wildlife in general, but you know, hearing all these amazing stories, how can you not make a small contribution to help an individual that's on the front line doing the hardest job while we're on, you know, under roof, warm, dry at night? These amazing people are out there looking out, you know, one objective, and that's it. That's to care and protect, and putting themselves in danger by doing that, protecting these rhinos. So going on the website, we'll have all these links in our show notes, but top right corner of your website, you click on the tab contribute, fill in your details, easy as that. So we can only encourage as many of our listeners to make a small contribution or bigger contribution depending where you're at. Kennedy, thank you so much. It's been absolutely enlightening to learn about something that, you know, for the most of us in Australia and New Zealand, we don't know. It's you know, ignorance is bliss. You know, for people especially who haven't traveled to Africa and have never even seen a rhino, the beauty of these giant, you know, calm, just they're absolutely incredible. You know, I've been fortunate enough to have seen rhino in the wild as well. They are important. We do know now, after a lot of these episodes, what happens in one country's ecology system impacts the rest of the world. So it is important. We should care about what happens in Africa. You lose that particular species, it affects a whole system. It impacts a lot more than we realize. So thank you so much for sharing your passion. Really, it's the work you do is incredible, and we can only wish you the best of luck with all these incredible projects in the future. And thank you so much for coming onto the show.
Thanks. It's been really great, and it's so fun to talk about. And I that you've become a monthly contributor is awesome. And I hope for you that you see on our Facebook page the stuff we're doing. The whole point is for you to feel a part of what we're doing, because you don't live in Africa. We tell the compelling stories so people know exactly where their money is going and why. And I hope for you, you're getting something out of that, to see that you're actually helping us do this stuff. We couldn't do it without you and other people. So, thanks so much. And we'll hit the ground running again soon in Africa, and we'll keep you in the loop.
Thank you for listening to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. If you found this interesting, make sure you subscribe and share it with your friends.